He played for Fitzroy, played for Hawthorn, about 50 games in total. From East Doncaster, he was a handy midfielder or tagger. That's how they described him. Kicked a goal for Fitzroy, kicked a goal for Hawthorn, just to keep it even. A total of 53 games. This was in the early 90s, up to about 95. And what's his journey been like since then? Well, it has been a journey, and a rather interesting one. Mark Bunn is in front of me. Hooray, Mark.
Hello, Richard.
Do you remember those two goals?
I do, very vividly, unfortunately. I think inglorious is the adjective to describe
really?
My career.
I don't think so. You played 53 games for the AFL. That's 53 more than I've played.
That's true.
And that means you had to be part of the culture, and you had to get through, and you made the cut.
Yes.
I'm sure you can remember kicking a goal for each team.
I do indeed. As I said, very vivid. And as you say, no, it was great to be part of two distinct, very different cultured clubs too. And going from Fitzroy to Hawthorn was quite a culture shock in itself and the professionalism. But yeah, no, the friendships.
What was the difference?
Fitzroy, I was speaking to someone at breakfast this morning, actually. And very much Fitzroy, the mentality was, you know, winning was good, but it wasn't expected. But as soon as you walked into Hawthorn, the expectation was that it was a winning club and, you know, we're here to win and there's no second sort of consideration.
And what do you think about those two philosophies?
I think there's good things in both of them. Fitzroy is, you know, people that do remember the great old Fitzroy was considered the family club. And so looking out the very narrow view of, you know, winning a football game, the culture around Fitzroy was just fabulous. You know, people looking after each other and life was more about just than the kicking the leather around. And, but also, you know, in a Western environment, obviously success and working together as a group to achieve a worthwhile goal is obviously important too, which Hawthorn was very successful at.
I was also thinking about the internal monologue that if we say to ourselves, because sometimes, I'm not necessarily saying the culture of the club or anything like that, but that's kind of our jumping off point. Sometimes if we say to ourselves, oh, it's not important, what we're really saying to ourselves is, I'm too scared to have a swing.
Mm.
There is a certain courage in failure, you know, that because you had a shot and you were honest with yourself about what you're attempting.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't saying, oh, it's not important, I don't need to, it doesn't matter, win or lose. No, it does. Have a crack. How about do your best? Let's be winners. Why not?
Yeah.
And deal with it. Don't be thin-shelled. Deal with failure, deal with success, but have the swing.
Yeah. I think that strikes to the heart of sports psychology, you know, and it's all about expectation. I think we know when we go into something without much of an expectation, we can actually surprise ourselves with how well we do, because that expectation, which sometimes breeds tension and stress, can inhibit our performance, and you take that expectation away, and sometimes players, individuals can really succeed very well.
So why am I talking to a footballer from the 90s about weird esoteric stuff, about internal monologues and what we tell ourselves? Well, because he's written a book called Ancient Wisdom. He's looked at the AFL and he's carefully looked at the sayings of its chairman, and Ancient Wisdom for Modern Health is, I guess, the outpourings of a journey that he's been on, Mark's been on, since his football time. But let's go back. What were your qualifications? What did you qualify as?
I went from high school into a Bachelor of Applied Science, and then went on to do an honours degree in exercise physiology, so very much about health and fitness from a conventional point of view.
Conventional to us.
Yes.
The Western conventional.
Western science.
And,
yes.
And then you went into the AFL and you were, so you've got your health and fitness science degree and you're living the life of protein and balanced and, you know, interval training and fartlek and metabolizing through weight training and
all that good stuff.
All that stuff that makes perfect sense and churns out elite athletes.
Yes.
All right. So why have I got this book in my hand? What happened after that?
Well, after my AFL career, I actually had the good fortune of travelling throughout Southeast Asia. And I used to like going out into the remote villages rather than just the main cities. I'd go out to the little villages where people had lived for thousands of years in very traditional ways. And something really struck me, as many people have done the same thing, noticed. And that was, despite them being dirt poor, hardly the shirt on their back or the roof over their head, they were always smiling. They had a big smile on their face, or they were laughing, and they seemed genuinely happy, of course, when I came back to Australia. We had million-dollar houses and fancy cars and supposedly the best medical system in the world and training philosophies. But everyone was depressed or stressed or overweight. I'm talking about the general public here as opposed to athletes. And that really struck home to me that maybe what we're doing in following the athletic way of health and fitness, which is very much based on no pain, no gain. You know, you've got to stress the body to the point of its limits and then let it recover, which is great in the short term. But we've got to ask the question is, why don't our elite athletes, why aren't they still playing at 35 and 40 and 45?
It's a young man's game, mate. It's a young man's game.
Yeah, but that stress over years and decades takes its toll. And in the Eastern tradition, that's quite the polar or the opposite of the way they see exercise and its purposes.
Well, yeah, but there's a big difference there. If we look at an activity, let's keep playing with football. If we look at an activity like football, there is a playing life. But that's not an activity that is for life. So what do I mean? Like, I was chatting the other day with, we were talking to Richard Norton, and I was talking about being in Japan and being at the Aikikai Center and watching senior training. So there you've got people in their 60s, men and women, and they've got a kind of rubbery energy to them. Yeah. They're very flexible. They're not muscly. They're not lean, but they're limber, flexible, rubbery. And I would say that they're in what is a martial art? They are training in the art for life, not for the peak of, okay, I'm going to be a kickboxer and competitive and I'll be that until I'm 25 or 20 or 30 and then I'm too old, too slow and I'll stop that activity. I'm going to be a footballer at that elite level and I'm going to play at that level and then I'll stop that activity.
Yes.
You're talking about a different thing. You're talking about activity for a different purpose.
Yeah.
To live.
That's right, yeah. And so for athletes, perfectly fine to do that for 5 or 10 years and make you $500,000 a year if you can in AFL, absolutely fantastic. But obviously for that wider perspective of people just in terms of general health and well-being and wanting to live a long and happy life, the idea in the Eastern traditions is that exercise is actually a vehicle to integrate mind and body and actually to promote that idea of what they call higher states of consciousness, and even in a spiritual level have that something called enlightenment. So it's a very sort of mind, body, spirit integrating activity.
What, you mean it's all one? They're just separate. I thought we could just work the body, get buffed, look good on the beach, don't worry about the spirit, and don't think ever. That'll work, won't it?
Well, you've got to work the six-pack, of course, and biceps. And
nothing's more important than how I look. It doesn't matter what's going on inside, does it?
You don't want your bum to look big in those jeans.
Hell no.
So, yes.
It's interesting. Okay, so you had that kind of epiphany where you looked down and went, wow, there's a contrast. They're all happy. They've got nothing. Where's their plasma TVs? we've got those, and what are we? We don't know what to eat. We respond, we eat because there's an ad, and so we eat that. You know, arguably we're the only species on the planet that's forgotten what it is we eat.
Yeah.
We just don't know. Set loose, what do we eat? I don't know. I eat till I die. Poison and I don't know. I don't know.
What's in front of me?
So what did you do? You travelled more? You studied more?
Yeah, that really intrigued my interest. So when I came back to Australia, I actually started to study formally into what's known as Ayurvedic medicine, which is India's traditional system of medicine. But when we actually understand Ayurveda, which is literally translated as science of life, it's actually a body of knowledge which represents universal and eternal, what they could call laws of nature. So we understand, we look it around even outside the window here, and we see nature working. You know, there's day, there's night, there's summer, there's winter. There's certain principles or laws that govern how our universe functions, and as humans, the Eastern cultures understand that we're actually intimately connected to those cycles. So there's different times of day that the body's designed to digest food, give it energy, times of day to exercise, times of day to sleep. And when you do that, it's like riding a wave on the ocean. Any good surfer will tell you, if you get the timing right, then nature does all the work and the experience is, it flows, there's an effortless to it. You know, we generally...
Well, you're saying we're a part of it. Exactly. No, we're separate. We're separate.
We like to control it.
Animals and stuff and plants might get affected by the planet. We don't. We're different. Separate.
Yeah, well, we can think that way, and probably our research shows that when we get to 60 and 65 and we get heart disease and type 2 diabetes and cancers at younger and younger ages these days, that maybe we're not so separate and we need to maybe turn track a little bit and start swimming with nature rather than going against it.
Maybe. That's where we get to the bit where it's your theory. Mark Bunn has, so he's taken all this and he's written down a book, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Health. And it's a really interesting book it talks a lot about the principles he's just described to us, and it talks a bit about how you would start to apply that to every day and some thoughts. And some of it's great, and some of it's backed up by flimsy science. some of it isn't backed up, is just a generality to prove a point. But rather than kind of trying to pick out the bits that I feel are fuzzy, I think it's more beneficial to just talk about the overview. If we just let that go and accept, let's try to hear the message. So, okay, there are seven wisdoms. And one of them, we start off with this notion that health and happiness aren't supposed to be complicated. And that's fairly revolutionary. Now let's talk about the wisdoms that you outline in your book. You can pick whichever one you want to start and have a chat about, and we'll try and work through a few of them. What do you think people need to start to do?
Well, I think just to touch on that quick point about the simplicity, on the back of the book, we have about these long-living cultures that now today, and it is very well researched, four or five long-living cultures that actually, they get to 80, 90, 100 years of age, and a high majority of them actually don't have cancer, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, all those sort of things. And very interesting, if you were to ask them how much they know about low carbohydrate diets, antioxidants, biochemicals, glycemic index, the answer is absolutely nothing. They've never heard of them. And that's what I mean by simple. The actual process of staying healthy is simple. And I think most people know a lot of it. It's just that we don't do it, or we get caught up in the practicalities of life, which makes it difficult. So the first wisdom is always the one that I often like to talk about, because I think it's one of the foundations of what we can do in our lives to live a healthier life. And also it's something that we often put, say, at the end of a book, and it's about emotional health. And in the Eastern traditions, they really value this idea of nurturing the heart value first before we get caught up in, you know, counting calories or
so. What does that mean?
Heart rate means.
What does that mean? I'm 10 kilos overweight. I'm 20 kilos overweight. Whatever. What the hell are you talking about? Nourish my heart. I've got to not eat sugars and I've got to stay away from... What does that mean?
That means that principally we know that stress is a fundamental obstructor to many of our good health advice. So you can talk to someone till you're blue in the face about you're 10 kilograms overweight and you need to reduce your amount of calories or eat less this sort of food or
kilojoules,
McDonald's.
And energy in, energy out.
Exactly. But if they're in a state of stress, that means 2 days later, stuff that advice, I'm going down to Hungry Jack's or, you know, McDonald's.
My
the same with exercise.
Change.
Exactly, that's right. And so stress is that central thing that obstructs all the good health advice, exercise, sleep, you name it. So if you can get rid of stress, then you're a long way to living more naturally. And as we know, the more we can reduce stress and in terms of nourish that emotions, the better we feel within ourselves, the more naturally we desire healthier food. We'll go for the healthy option rather than the junk food or the chocolate. We're more motivated to exercise because we want to feel better. And so it's like, you know, we start a new relationship. You know, if someone finds the perfect partner and for a week or two, they feel fantastic. They want to exercise. They eat well. You know, they break up with their boyfriend and they're down the chocolate shop and can't eat enough. So that idea of nourishing the heart is really just that, getting that emotional balance.
There's so many interesting things to chat about out of this. How did our society get to the point where we think eating poison is what we do for comfort? So we eat the worst foods, the most processed, the most sugary, the most saturated fats, the things that insects won't eat because they don't recognize it as food.
Yeah.
We go to that and call it comfort.
Yes.
And we generally look at exercise as just a drag and unnatural and to be avoided.
Yes.
What is going on with that? Why do we do that? What do you think?
Fantastic question. Well, in terms of the exercise, actually, even modern science is now showing that we actually become addicted to junk food just as drug addicts get addicted to a drug high. There's certain neurochemical pathways, if you want to get too scientific about it, in our brain that need to be stimulated. If we don't get that through our emotional connections or passionate job.
Okay. When you say, I think, I'm okay with it. When you say an abstract like medical science is now saying, I just go, munyaka. There might be a sugar addiction we could talk about or a physiological, but the principle that you think we get in love with the rush, is that what you're saying? We get in love with the...
Yeah,
so to take the feeling that it gives us.
Yeah, no, so it's a good point. So let's take it out of a scientific example, and that's actually how I like to talk. I actually, as you've probably noticed in the book, I try and get away from science because exactly your point. You know, it's one study says this, and the next study comes out next week and says the exact opposite. So from an intuitive or an intrinsic feeling level, we know as humans we are nourished by certain things. Now, food on a physical level is one. And the Eastern cultures, what they say also is that we need to be nourished on an emotional level. Mm. So if we are in a job that we really love, people know that they get some fulfillment from that, and maybe they are less than likely to need to go and get that from food or some other outlet. And so over time, I think with diet, I think in the Western way, we are going into jobs. We go into jobs because it pays $20,000 more, or we've got to stay in a job we don't like because we've got to pay the bills, which is perfectly understandable in some ways. But over time, what that does is that heart doesn't get its fulfillment, so we seek it from external sources.
You know, I'm very happy to have this discussion because there's a whole lot of stuff, and I don't want to look at the science, which sounds contradictory.
I'm with you.
Because the science can go either way, and I can argue and I can show test, and it's not definitively proved, but I want to kind of, what I can say is that it seems like we're gaining weight in society. We're not, which is a, so what? Well, just that's a measurement of the health index, really, on all sorts of levels. And I've got this belief that if I work, let's take the worker example, if I work away at something I don't like, my body will react physically to my emotional stress. Now, that sounds ridiculous, that I will get an illness because I am not happy, simplistically. But I feel that. I've got no evidence for it. Mm. I've got no, and there's, I'm sure, doctors who'd snort at me, but I really feel that there's a connection. So I'm interested in discussions.
Yes.
Without looking at the fine data. I mean, as people are, I could SMS and look at, oh, but these cultures, they've got their own illnesses.
Yes.
Yeah, they probably have. But that doesn't stop the point that I think you're trying to get to in this book of showing, oh, that there's a different way. You could choose something else. Mm. We're jumping around a lot because we'll have a limited time, but you make a point about sleep. Let's talk about sleep and sleeping hours.
Yes.
Go ahead. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, there's some really key points on sleep. And again, traditionally from our Western viewpoint, we often hear that we need to get 6 or 7 or 8 hours sleep. And one of the key distinctions from the Eastern cultures is, just as in food, that it's not just the amount of calories we eat that determines whether we gain or lose weight, but it's when we take those calories in. And it's this idea, as we spoke about, this idea of natural cycles. There's certain times of the day when the body is designed to do certain physiological functions, like riding that wave. So from 10 p.m. till 2 a.m., basically the body goes through 6 4-hour cycles every single day. So from 10 p.m. till 2 a.m. is a 4-hour window when the Ayurvedic, what they call the rishis or the seers, the tradition of Ayurveda, say there is a cycle that the body, we call it the nighttime rejuvenation cycle. It's when the body is designed to get rid of its stress, get rid of its fatigue, detox the liver, rejuvenate the physiology. So it's not just getting 6 or 7 or 8 hours sleep, but it's when you get it. If you can actually get that, like, you know, the old wives' tale, early to bed, early to rise makes a man or woman healthier, wealthy and wise. And we sort of laugh at granny and say, oh, you know, she's losing her marbles and such and such.
So the people who are vomiting right now, who say, I'm not a morning person, I will wake up badly, yes. I need coffee before I can even breathe,
yes.
People are on different cycles, shut up.
Yeah.
What do we say to them?
We say to them to do a little experiment, and that is when you've got a little day or two blank in your diary, come home on night, pack your knapsack, turn off your alarm clock, your computer, your lights, anything technological, and then preferably go out camping in the forest when you've got a holiday. If not, just dim the lights, turn all off technology, no TV, anything, just an experiment. And with one or two nights, I guarantee you they'll be asleep at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and they'll wake up with the birds. It's generally because we violate the natural cycle over time that people get this feeling that they're not a morning person. There's absolutely no such thing as a not a morning person. Human beings are designed to wake up in the morning.
Western medicine says going short on sleep, there are correlations with all sorts of illnesses. What does your teachings say about going short on sleep? 6 hours, 5 hours average a night,
yeah,
at odd times, what's that like? Is that good?
It's different for different people. Mm-hmm. Again, just like everything, calories in, calories out, types of exercise. We all have an individual body type too, and that's in Ayurveda a very key understanding, that what's right for one is not necessarily right for others. But one of the recent, again, harking back to research, for what it's worth, some science is now showing that getting insufficient or lack of good quality sleep over time is having a lot of effect on things like type 2 diabetes. And because if the body's not getting rid of those stresses and revitalizing the liver and the pancreas and all those sort of things, it makes sense. So it's really enough to skip to the last chapter of the book, basically, which is really to listen to your own body. And the body, we actually, because there's so many experts out there and TV shows and telling us what to do, we actually have forgotten this wisdom that the body will actually remind us of what we need. If you're absolutely dirt tired, then get some more sleep. If you're hungry, eat. So sometimes it's not as complicated as we make out.
Ancient Wisdom for Modern Health is the book. Rediscover the simple, timeless secrets of health and happiness. Now, Mark Bunn is the author, and he's put together all these thoughts. And, yeah, I think we can pick holes. Some of you are SMSing, went on a trek to Nepal. They're happy and smiling, but they've got their highest infant mortality in the world and one of the lowest life expectancies. It's not what it's cracked up to be. Yeah, there's lots of aspects of that. But what we also can say is the diet industry makes billions, and no one loses weight permanently through diet. So the methodology that we're using isn't working. So if you want to look around and see, well, what else is there? What could there be outside of that? Then maybe this is a good starting point, because he's outlined a lot of things. He talks about foods, and he, not surprisingly, he's not a big fan of processing all the foods. More processing, good.
Tasty.
I love your analysis of the sandwich. Oh, yeah, and then top it off with salt. Blah. What can we do instead? So There's practical things in there, as well as the philosophical thoughts that Mark's been sharing with us here. So, yeah, if you are interested in this, you could do much worse than pick it up and have a look. Ancient Wisdom for Modern Health. Mark, thank you so much. Thanks for coming in and playing with me and answering all those questions.
Thanks, Richard. Keep up the great work.